5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Earth below us, drifting, falling, flow.
Welcome to AnnaZone 23, where we look at old anime, especially movies and OVAs. These are the films and projects that help shape the anime landscape as we know it today. We want to look at them in their own era and how they were the inspiration for many of the shows and franchises that are popular today. Some have become legends, while others have been deservedly forgotten. All of them, you should remind yourself, someone had to draw that. Thanks, Major Tom. Welcome to another episode of AnnaZone 23. I'm Rick.
I'm Drew.
And on today's episode, we are talking about a someone who's had a lot of inspiration, or has been a big inspiration within the anime production community, and is a name, or even if you're not familiar with him, you're certainly familiar with his works, to the point where one of his works actually is now a Hollywood movie that was made a few years ago. Didn't do very well, had some controversy about it, but we will talk to that when we get to that particular work's creation. But our subject today is the early works of Masamune Shirow. Particularly, we are talking today about Black Magic, M66, Appleseed, and Dominion. So, Drew, you want to go into a little bit of background about Shirow himself? And
Well, Shirow is an interesting case of the early mangakas, because Appleseed was one of the very first animated manga to get over into the U.S., but it was one of the first that wasn't brought out by Viz, and it was sort of a result of Torrin Smith talking to everybody and reading all the manga, because Viz had brought him in to go through all their books and find stuff that could be launched in the U.S., and he said... pulled out a bunch of shows and said, yeah, these would do good. And they said, well, you also listed this comic, you know, we don't own those. He's like, yeah, but they'd be rather successful. Maybe you should try to get the rights. And his boss looked at it and said, maybe you should try to get the rights. And this is the problem. This is a Japanese boss. That's a Japanese boss telling you to go die. Torrin Smith didn't read it that way. He went out and got the rights. That's where you got Studio Proteus from, which originally published through Eclipse and now publishes, or whatever is left from it, publishes through Dark Horse. And he had his own, soon had his own side project of comics that were not Shogakukan that were coming out, and he was doing his own side work. There's a certain amount of bitterness. He also still worked for Viz for a number of years because Miyazaki was the only one who would let him touch Nausicaa. But rather, Miyazaki would only allow Torrin Smith to translate Nausicaa because he trusted him. But that's a story for another day.
That was a similar situation with the American releases of some of his more recent films with Pixar. Is that it's because he, despite the issues with John Lasseter, he created quite a friendship with him, and that's basically locked Pixar and Disney into having that distribution deal for the foreseeable future, at least. At least if he comes out with any new films. For that particular situation, I don't know if that's Miyazaki himself or Ghibli in general, but that's not who we're here to talk about today. We're here to talk about Masamune Shirow and his individual works.
And so his works took off pretty early. The interesting thing is we're going to talk about them in kind of slightly different order than the order they got seen. Because Black Magic is part of his debut work, which was a weird sort of magical sci-fi thing, with thus the Black Magic. And it's actually a story called Booby Trap. And as I mentioned in the Dirty Pair one, it's actually kind of a weird variation of a Terminator story.
Kind of what I got the impression of is we have many shows that do the Terminator plot in our
in a minute in what makes this particular one unique. But he was most notable for Appleseed, which was a real deep dive cyberpunk police show, And the police stuff really rolls in with Shiro. Shiro does Mecha, Pretty Girls, and Police. And not necessarily in that order. It was generally referred to as, like, Futuristic Hill Street Blues, which tells you how long ago it got going.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, Hill Street Blues hasn't been on the air regularly for a long time.
Another thing with Shiro is those particular three things sometimes aren't exactly separate either.
No, you'll have sometimes pretty...
They're wrapped up all in one.
He tends to wrap them all together. He became very well known for... Appleseed had a real cult following, but it came out very slowly because he was bringing it out monthly or less because Shiro was not a professional mangaka or a full-time professional mangaka. He was a hobbyist mangaka. He actually had a job as a teacher for a long time before he quit. And he's also unique, and he was based in Kobe, down near Osaka, the port area of Osaka, basically. Not in Tokyo, where 90% of mangaka are based. So he's sort of like that American artist who works out of San Francisco instead of New York, which is an unusual split. But all three of his series were doing pretty good, so when anime started to roll out, everybody started looking for them, and his first three series had all been animated, but they were all animated by small studios during the OVA boom on small budgets. And
as I see here, with the first one we're going to talk about, it's Anime International Company for Black Magic. I'd have to actually look up for Appleseed, because there's a few different posts on Appleseed.
The general consensus is Gainax was the primary animator on it, and they brought in a lot of other things, but they had no creative control over it to speak of.
Actually, fun story. Actually, it wasn't all small studios. Appleseed was produced by Bandai Visual.
Yeah, I think there was some Bandai. They may have been the top. They may have been the distributor level thing, because they still had connections to Gainax. Or vice versa. Gainax might have been roped in because Bandai Visual needed a studio to knock out this one-hour OVA.
Yeah.
And Dominion is another side project from a rather small studio. It's just four little side bits. Tone-wise, it's probably the most different from its original manga source.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that Dominion is not comedic. Dominion is the funniest of the three by far, but Dominion is more black comedy.
It's very much so. We'll get to that when we talk about the show. Dominion, I looked it up actually. It was two separate studios that did the original Dominion Tank Police OVA. The first two were Ginga Taiko or Taikoku, mm-hmm. and Agent 21 did the second two.
Which fits because they're two entirely different stories.
Yeah, they also, like, those two studios don't even have a posting. Like, that gives you an idea of how small those studios were. Well done, but, you know, still quite small. So let's go ahead and get into detail on our first subject here tonight on Shiro, which is Black Magic M66. Now, when I watched this one, the first thing that came to mind was I was watching it. The story isn't like it's solid, but it's not like anything super memorable. As we said earlier, it's basically a Terminator. It's got some unique elements, but the thing that kind of stood out to me is there is a lot of really ambitious shots in this OVA. Like in 45 minutes, there's some really ambitious camera moves.
I believe that this is a factor of small studio. Shiro was actually the official director. I don't know if he had an assistant director to help him, but I think Shiro may have made some demands of artists that a real director would never have thought of doing because of the sheer time sink involved in it.
Actually, the director is listed as Hiroyuki Kitakubo.
I've also heard Shiro was
directly involved in it. Kitakubo is notable for Robot Carnival, Rosion Z, Golden Boy, and Blood the Last Vampire.
Okay.
So, I mean, if you've seen any of those other ones, and some of those we'll actually talk about in future episodes,
Those are adventurously animated already.
Yes, especially things like Robot Carnival.
Mm-hmm.
Which I want to do a whole show on that because that's a fascinating piece of work there.
That's an interesting place to talk about a bunch of different artists.
Yes.
But the point is, you had two guys that are willing to do an awful lot of adventurous animation for what's not a very adventurous story. Because originally it was just a side story. It was the Terminator story for this girl and her mad scientist grandfather, basically.
Because it's always the mad scientist grandfather.
It's always the mad scientist grandfather. And they put the woman reporter in as more of a framing device. I think she's a character in the original story, but they really emphasized her to make it more of a framing device because it's her story is she's chasing a scoop, finds out about the two robots that have escaped, and ends up tracing the second robot to its target and spends a fair chunk of the last half of the movie protecting this airheaded bimbo from the robot until the commandos can catch up and finally neutralize the second one. Not without a lot of casualties. And this first, the reporter character is, she is another character that might give Kay a run for her money in the butchest anime character in existence at the time
Sybil.
Came out. Yeah, Sybil. Sybil don't give a shit. And we love her for it.
You learn that in the first, 4 minutes?
Sybil comes out of the shower because the phone's ringing. She's a freelance reporter. She sees that there's something going on down on the highway. Get out there, get some film, whatever. She grabs her bag with her equipment, grabs her camera, grabs a case of film, and runs out the door wearing a towel over her shoulder and nothing else. Beat the door open. She comes back in. She sighs, grabs her pants and her shirt, throws them over her other shoulder, and runs out.
Yes. Note we did not say she puts them on.
Yeah. She doesn't even bother to put them on. She can get dressed in the car.
But actually, she's dressed by the time she gets down to the car.
Yeah.
Which is even more impressive.
Yeah. We don't know how she did it, but like you said, she's... The interesting thing, though, that makes... One is the sheer detail they go into on the commandos trying to knock out the robots.
Yeah. There's
a lot of tactical porn, of teamwork and everything else. All of that stuff working really good. Thematically, it's an interesting Terminator story because you essentially have Sarah Connor from Terminator 2 being sent to rescue Sarah Connor from Terminator 1, which is an interesting spin, but he did this 5 years before Terminator 2 had come out.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I take a note that we'll get into that. We'll get into the a bit of the story here in a minute. Kind of the main plot driver in this particular one. But at one point, you kind of have a little bit of aliens in there as well. With the one group of special forces soldiers.
Yeah, because they do, like I said, they take a lot of losses trying to get...
Oh, yeah. Oh, and they're all given, kind of quirky personalities. And
yeah.
Which would make sense, at least for the OVA, because this came out... This would have come out, almost 1 year after Aliens.
Mm-hmm.
So...
And they have their requisite the commandos also have the requisite butch, tough girl character, which is, as I pointed out in the Dirty Pair episode, is voiced by Kyoko Tengu, which is Kay, which made it doubly fun when the Dirty Pair basically parodied the same thing in their Halloween episode, and Ms. Tengu did not recognize, hey, haven't I been here before? This is a very familiar story. Well, ship crashes, robots escape. It's a tale as old as time.
Well, and then you look at some of the names of some of the commandos too. You have Nakamura, Rico, Roger, Paco.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those are just, I'm like, it just screams that, We read Heinlein and we watched Cameron.
Yeah. And plus you have Shiro, who never saw a cop movie he didn't like.
Yeah, that too.
Loves his squad room stuff. I mean, we'll get to that a little bit more of that, but it's basically reporter chick, you know, finds out that there's a monster on the loose, figures out where it's going, and gets there ahead of the monster, and then the rest of the movie is her and the scientist's airheaded granddaughter running all over the place trying to get away from it, including up into a skyscraper.
Yeah.
And then you have scenes like they're trapped in the skyscraper and they have this big magnetic dish that can kind of repulse it. So you do a 360 spin of the camera to show how it can't get through, and you're like, man, you guys really just blew the entire budget on that one shot, didn't you?
Well, it's also interesting because you both had budget and not that much, and you could also tell they were short on budget.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was so obvious whenever the background was going to move in an interesting way.
Yeah.
Because there'd be almost like no shading whatsoever.
Yeah, that's the only way you could pull that kind of stuff off. If you were careful and you wanted to do that, that's partly why you have action line.
Yeah.
Then you just have to keep the characters in perspective. This is why I think that Shiro definitely had some input on it, because Shiro just didn't give a damn about the, you know, it's hard to do it that way.
Damn the accountants. Full speed ahead.
Yeah, pretty much. He must have inspired the staff, because the staff won't do that no matter what you say. Unless you are really inspiring. So he must have really done a bit. But yeah, when it all comes out, Blackmagic M66 is essentially a fan letter to James Cameron. But it is interesting that he essentially anticipated the arc that Terminator 2 would take with Sarah Connor.
Yeah.
He essentially... The Terminator TV series might have done it. Have they had one where Sarah Connor goes back to rescue herself yet?
I'm not sure. Let me Google that real quick. Well, we keep talking about that it's mentioned Terminators. One of the things that makes it different from Terminator, at least at that time, that's the fact that there are two of them.
Yes, but that's so that they can have one to show just how hard it is to stop by the commandos, and then one that she has to get out ahead of. So it does have the effect of showing it can be killed. But she doesn't have all the guns and everything else that they do.
So, as far as I can tell, I don't know about one where there was two. Where one Sarah Connor saved another Sarah Connor.
Yeah, I believe the reason they went with two robots is because it's the same way in the manga. It basically gives them a chance to show just how dangerous the thing is before it goes setting off after its target. It establishes the stakes. It's like saying, okay, how tough is this robot? It's like, this robot is tough enough that it gave these commandos the fight of their lives and killed several of them. This one reporter chick, no matter how tough she is, and no matter... she's not going to beat this without wearing pants. This is not something that's an easy job. She's just trying to try to keep the girl alive until the commandos can catch back up with them. So... it's a very small and obscure OVA. Though it's the first out, it's generally it was the last release to the U.S. It has been pretty much in print almost the entire time anime has been available in the U.S., probably because it was available cheap as chips, would be my simplest guess. Plus, it gets its nudity right out of the gate, which is always a good thing in the early OVA times. You know.
Yeah, I mean, this is the earliest. The OVA is 1987. The manga itself is 1983.
Yeah.
It's not a great, like, I wouldn't say it's a great OVA, but it's definitely solid. It's got a decent enough story. It's another one of those where I think that it kind of is a case of tropes before they were tropes.
A little bit of that, and it's also showing that even though I'm just doing a Terminator story, and even though I've only been at this for a while, I have some interesting ideas of how to do the Terminator story.
Mm-hmm.
So I have at least a few interesting tricks. Not all that many interesting tricks. I mean, it is still almost like a head-on collision between Terminator and Aliens, as you said. But it's still... it's certainly more interesting than a lot of the other Japanese Terminator riffs we've seen.
Yeah, definitely. Because we, I mean, in the 80s, you couldn't swing a bat without hitting a Terminator knockoff in the anime scene. I mean, Dirty sometimes Bear, you had
less than three
in one series.
Yes.
Yeah.
Dirty Bear did it three times, folks. And that doesn't even count like Bubblegum Crisis, which is up to its armpits in Terminator Clones.
Yeah. Yeah. So after that, we have our next one, I believe, is Appleseed. And now Appleseed for me actually holds kind of a special place. Not the original, but the 2004 remake.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember if it's a remake or technically or a sequel.
The Appleseed computer generated stories are in general a separate universe.
Yeah.
They change enough canon stuff.
Because that was Shinji Aramaki that did those.
Yes.
And it was Kazu. So the original OVA was directed by Kazuyoshi Katayama.
Mm-hmm.
We have talked about some of his works before on this show, by the way. Space Adventure Cobra. Maurice the Chojo.
Hmm.
And he's someone I really, really like, because he is also the series director for Big O.
Ah,
which if you haven't heard about Big O, those listeners, Big O is what if Batman, but giant robot
in Dark City, Batman with a giant robot in Dark City. That's Big O in two senses.
Yeah,
but Appleseed, the OVA, is a 60-minute... it's an attempt to tell about the first two volumes worth of story in 60 minutes, with some original stuff added in. There are certain scenes that are kind of out of context from the manga that are incorporated. There are several scenes that are not incorporated. And a lot of the animation was covered by what was Studio Gynax. Gynax. But Gynax doesn't put a whole lot of their spin on this at all. It is very workmanlike. It also shows that Shiro is a fascinating artist. He has cool mecha designs, but they're not necessarily... there is not enough time and money put into trying to make them animatable.
Yeah, the one of the big things with Shiro is that, and you'll especially see this in some of his later works even as well, and I think that's why Shiro actually translates to CG really well later in the 2000s, is he goes super deep, like all of his art is super detailed.
Yes.
Like, he puts in so many small details and technology and, you know, all that stuff into his art, especially when he does splash pages.
Yeah, I don't remember if this is for sure, but I think he also worked on smaller pages than most people, which would also heighten the amount of detail that you have, because you're not, or he worked on a super big size, and then it got shrunk. I think
the big size shrunk down might make more sense.
That makes more sense.
Because it's much easier it's much easier to draw big and then shrink down using like a copying process.
Yeah, the other thing is he almost never employed assistants, which is why his book was usually, you know, coming out in dribs and drabs.
Yeah, but as a result of that, his art is very consistent.
Mm-hmm.
It's very consistent.
The problem is that there's not nearly as much background detail in the Appleseed OVA. There's a lot of pretty common camera views. The voice acting is a little bit uninspired. The plot when you can actually follow it is okay, but nothing that hasn't been done before. You have basically, you have some of the, it does have some of the thing that Appleseed has, which is the whole post-apocalyptic city in the clouds bit, but all of the corruption and everything from the old world is still floating around in this city. So they still need police. There's still conspiracies everywhere. Everything has an agenda on everything. And our heroes, Dwaynen and Briarios, are essentially pawns for most of it. They have, occasionally they get to have a lot of agency and solve problems at a level well above their pay grade. But they are only vaguely aware of half the plots that are going on most of the time. They are.
Yeah, and that's definitely the case with this one. One of the things that I like to point out with these two, and with all of these ones, and we'll get to it later when we talk more about it, is that you see elements of probably what among anime fans is maybe his most notable work. As I mentioned at the top of the show, he did get a show that was made into a, or a work that was made into a Hollywood movie. Many of you may have heard of Ghost in the Shell. All of the works we're talking about today, you can definitely see elements of that in this show. And one of the big elements that's in this one is cyborgs.
Yeah, because Briarios is a full body replacement cyborg.
Yeah,
he's about 8 foot tall, all made out of metal. In theory, he looks like a guy from the with dreadlocks from the Caribbean before he got fried. We do see occasionally see pictures of it. And Dwaynen Newt is the daughter of a Green Beret from before the atomic whoops happened and everything went to hell from the old world, who got trained by her daddy and his assistant Briarios up to pretty remarkable levels. And she's, you know, pretty tough, pretty. Definitely has a little girly side, but is mostly tough chick all the way through.
And again, she's also very similar to our protagonist in Black Magic.
Yes, well, here's the thing: as specific to Black Magic, yeah, as very much like the character in Black Magic. Unlike the Major to come later, Dwaynen is specifically, well, on one side she's a, she's American Anglo of some sort or another, but it's never brought up. But she once, one time, she gives Utomi, her minder friend, and also Byroid, which is like a android that you, it's like a biological android. It's a human that's not a human. And they're the ones that run the class. And Utomi is a fairly low-ranking Byroid, and she's a bit of a airhead, truth be told. But yeah, she's out in a spa with Utomi, and she gives her the rundown of her ancestry, and it's like she, her other side is basically a whole bunch of people that were wandering around Africa for about four different generations. So she's probably about an eighth African in some way, shape, or form. There's a lot of mixed races in there. She says that her mother basically got picked up by her dad while he was over on a mission. Until he was paying attention. So, Shiro's also said that one of the reasons Dwaynen is put up with by her superiors is that she basically won the genetic lottery. She has all kinds of physical talents. She's not mentally and psychologically the world's greatest cop.
At times, she's a little bit of used brick on bad guy.
Yeah. She has a very short temper. She doesn't think things through very much. She does the bit from Uncommon Valor one time during a test where she takes on about half of her team and beats all of them, including putting the insulting signs over their heads. If you've ever seen the bit in Uncommon Valor where the
they try
to hunt down the one guy, she does the same thing, and she has the signs even.
So
it's clear that Shiro has definitely seen that show. The problem with the show is, it's plot-wise, it's a mess. And it's And more than the plot, the storytelling pace is a real mess.
A little bit. It's not the worst thing in the world. But it definitely kind of feels like at times it feels convenient.
It feels very much like a generic 80s OVA. It looks like one.
I don't know if it quite looks like one. There's a lot of uniqueness in this one, flavor-wise, in terms of appearance. Mostly because of Shiro's style.
The robot, let's put it the landmates, the one-man robots, those look fairly unique. The human characters I've seen in 100 OVAs.
Well, I mean, yeah, they're pretty much...
And Briarios is very... block is very, you can tell they minimalized him for animation. They're like, this guy's going to be hell to animate, so let's simplify the design as much as we can. Let's not move his ears if we can help it.
Despite the fact that's a major point of his design.
Yeah.
So a couple things I want to talk about in regards to Appleseed, and specifically how it affects other, other sci-fi properties. One, we're just talking about Briarios. I think it's very possible that Briarios inspired Pat Labor.
They're roughly contemporary.
Pat Labor, actually, the manga is Appleseed is pre Pat Labor.
It's possible there. I think
because,
they might.
Pat Labor came out. The manga started in 88. And the OVA came in 88 for
Alphonse and Briarios both have those little ears with the cameras on the end. I think that that's actually, they're probably both drinking from the same well.
It's quite possible. But another thing that we're talking about, Byroids, I find this funny because you also have the replicants from Blade Runner, which is earlier on. Mm-hmm. That concept seemed to die a bit in Western science fiction, because I remember last year, when Picard was airing, they're making a big deal out about this idea of, like, they're talking about they're androids, but they're basically human. I'm like, they're Byroids.
Mm-hmm.
They're biological androids.
Yeah.
Dear God, anime's been doing this for, like, it's been doing this since Blade Runner came out and gave them the idea.
Well, the thing is, most of the anime that did Byroids were done by people who were deep geeks and had read a lot of certain stories.
But even in like some other bits of Western sci-fi, it's like mainstream Western sci-fi that forgot about the concept of Byroid. Because Fallout 4, actually, one of the major plot points is that, or one of the major plot lines is that there is an organization that is replacing people with Byroids.
Yeah, but when people go that way, they tend to go more the body snatchers, alien.
Yeah, they do.
So they go more the body snatchers route. So, and I think a lot of writers think that just having a robot but human is too lazy.
Despite the fact there's a lot of interesting things you can do with that.
This is true, but...
But that's neither here or there.
It doesn't cover through the whole bit. They also have the whole bit that Dwaynen and Briarios are a couple. Dwaynen will fully insist it, despite the fact that Briarios is quite literally nothing but a hunk of metal, as far as we know.
Dwaynen is asexual. I'm not judging.
Yeah, Dwaynen, who knows? I'm not going to ask her. She'll beat the shit out of me.
Exactly. That's something you don't ask a lady. There's also one other thing.
Or her, for that matter.
You don't ask a lady that. Or Dwaynen.
Or Dwaynen.
There's one other thing we talked about a little bit, and that there is a Overwatch. Definitely draws some inspiration from this.
Shiro has several different designs of basically wearable mechs, and for his sort of Starship Trooper designs, he tends to use what are called slave arms, which is your arms go into these little external sleeves that manipulate little baby arms that are mounted about a foot and a half below the main arms of the robot, and which mimic whatever you do in those slave arms is mimicked at a larger scale by the big arms. And meanwhile, your legs are in the top half of the robot's legs, and your head is at about the breastbone level of the robot. Which is, he does a lot of very technical drawings about how you can get into there. And he's drawn a lot of, but he's also drawn some reclining mechs, where you climb in and your controls, are ahead of you, and your position is more or less prone. And he'll kind of, the Tachikoma kind of worked that way too, if I remember.
Well, we'll talk about Tachikoma here in a little bit, because our next
but Shiro is also famous for doing a lot of just side art of pretty girls in skin-tight costumes and robots. Yeah. And if you've ever seen Diva, Diva is essentially a Shiro girl. She's wearing a little bit more clothing than most Shiro girls, but she may as well be a Shiro girl. And the other thing about those Shiro girls is, believe it or not, Shiro girls have a pretty large female fandom, too. I had a friend that every year wanted the Shiro calendar.
I was actually just taking a quick Google search to see if I can find anyone that drew Diva in Masamune Shiro style. And I don't see one, which is unfortunate, because I think that'd be a...
It's hard. The Diva's original style is pretty damn close to Shiro anyway. Her robot is dead on Shiro design.
Yeah, well, I just mean with some of his art touches.
Yeah, but he doesn't have as many distinctive art touches, especially when he's doing the girls, because he doesn't go with near as many. Those are usually done in paint or pastels, so they're not as heavily hatched.
Well, I found one, so.
There you go. You're going to have to put that in my chat window at some point. So.
I put that in our chat so you can see that. It's not the best, but it's not bad. I give it a 7.5 out of 10.
Yeah, that's very much Diva as a Shiro character.
So. Appleseed's one of those ones more so than Black Magic. I think in terms of staying power behind, obviously Ghost in the Shell, which again, we'll talk about at a later date.
Appleseed is the dry run for Ghost in the Shell.
It is. And it's also the one that's had the most staying power as well. I mean, When you look at it, it's got, we have the film, the manga, the same name. Obviously, the manga came out starting in 1985.
Had like 5 volumes, so
it's a short one. It was 4 volumes. You have the manga. You've got Black Magic M66. You have Black Magic M66. You have the manga and the anime, and that's pretty much it. Appleseed. You've got you've got the first OVA, which is the one we're talking about, which is 88. You have a CGI feature film in 2004, a sequel to that in 2007, a reboot that was released in 2014. So I'm going to have to see that one. I haven't watched that one. By the way, interesting, like I said earlier, the Appleseed CGI films, the first and the second one, both directed by Shinji Aramaki. What was interesting with the second one was John Woo produced.
Yep.
Yes, that John Woo. There was a canceled anime series in that was originally going to be in 2005. It was unveiled in 2008. There was a whole lawsuit involved, it looks like, involving production. It never happened. There was a TV series that came out in 2011, which was released as a 13-episode ONA series, and that was CG animated. And then that became... the 2 feature films. The first one was Appleseed 13 Tartarus and then Appleseed 13 Onoros, released on June 13th and October 24th of 2011, respectively. And then there was also games.
Yeah. And it's had a lot of legs, and it really built Studio Proteus in the US side.
Yeah.
This was their big go-to story.
That's the other big influence I didn't respond to with Appleseed. Appleseed was direct. Do you remember the film Chappie?
Heard of it.
He the director for Chappie actually admitted that Briarios is the direct inspiration for the main character of that film's design.
I mean, Briarios is sort of one of the original cyborg type characters. If you're going to run into one, and he's the only sane man, because Dwayne certainly ain't sane.
No, she is not.
No, she
would not tell that to her face.
No.
So moving on from Appleseed, then we have one that actually is probably got amongst fan groups, even though Appleseed has had more staying power. I think this next one is probably the most, I'd say, well-known. And I think because of the three, it's the most accessible. And it, that would be Dominion Tank Police. Yes,
Dominion Tank Police, specifically the first four OVAs.
Yeah, New Dominion is strange and weird, and it makes me uncomfortable.
New Dominion is closer to the manga, but it's not a very good adaption, is the problem. Dominion is essentially the story of a girl in the police and her tank.
Yes, and you heard that correctly.
Yes, it's the tank police, because the world has gotten so polluted that now everybody has to wear full reciprocating oxygen masks to go outside most days. There are crimes committed every 30 seconds. The tank police's job is to make sure it's not every 20 seconds.
I just want to point this out that, yes, this was a manga that was written in the late 80s, talking about, which basically is a dark comedy about police excessism.
Yes, it is. It's very much a... It's very much playing to the... It's very dark comedy, because the cops are... The world is bad, and the cops are almost as bad, and getting worse would probably be the best description. Leona's a pretty gung-ho police officer, but really, Leona's biggest thing is her great love of her life, which is her tank, Bonaparte.
Yes.
I remember, there's a famous quote, she's talking to her driver, Al. That wall of steel was an indomitable force, striking fear into the foes of decency. You took that immutable wall and scratched it. So, poor Al is basically playing second fiddle to the girl's mount, so to speak.
When this is another one where it's like I don't know if this is a police station or a special forces group.
It's kind of hard to tell at that level, because it's very
they're playing croquet with grenades.
The anime. The manga isn't quite that
goofy.
It's not that goofy. The anime, like you said, the manga is dark comedic. The fact that they're regular tank police are driving around in full-size tanks is, you know, overkill enough.
Well, yeah, they look like if any of you have ever if sometime those of you listening look up I think it's the T-60 or T-57.
Yeah, they look like some of the old autoloader tanks.
Yeah,
but they've got big curved bodies. They look kind of like 40K Eldar tanks in some weird way, because they almost float, and they
Think like the tank from Valkyria Chronicles, and the Trade Federation battle tanks from Episode 1 had a baby.
Yeah, they go floating around, terrifying bad, you know, evildoers like Braku and his two hench women or hench beings, Annapurna and Unipuma, who are basically two cat girls. And it's a dark but very silly. But at some levels, pretty silly manga. There's also Leona's way of handling a hostage crisis. She drives her tank into the basement bar and starts shooting. Actually, she drives in and says, go ahead, waste the... She basically gives the whole Dirty Harry thing of, go ahead, waste the hostages. I'll get a couple of marks on my thing, and you're coming out in a body bag.
Oh, and the names of some of these characters are just... some of the names of the police. You've got you didn't mention Drew. You called him Al, but you did not give the full name of Al.
Oh yeah, Al's got a really long ass name.
It's like Al. It's Al apostrophe C U space A D space S O L T E. When they made the dub, they said fuck it and changed his name to Al Southwell.
Mm-hmm. Which might be somewhat close to what it was originally. Probably.
Well, then you have the squad leader Charles Brenton.
Charles Brenton.
It's not Britain. It's Brenton, which is apparently a reference to the Brenton handgun.
Yeah, there's a lot of gun references in this show, folks.
Chaplin, Jim E. Lovelock.
Mohican, Megane.
The poor chief.
Yeah, the chief. Yeah, the anime takes the same idea and does it more straight up comedically. It's not quite as dark comic as much as just, it's still dark comic because there's a dialogue between the chief and Commander Britain over the opening credits.
It takes the 90s Simpsons take on police brutality, which involves Leona in a bunny outfit playing a very dangerous version of roulette.
That's the second one. The first one she walks in. Yeah, the first one she walks in and they're playing grenade golf.
Yes, grenade croquet.
They're using the butts of their M16s to hit grenades into a platform that is holding a bucket of water that is basically tied to a rope that is tied to a grenade, to the pin of a grenade that's stuck in the suspect's mouth.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, there, as they said, they're putting the terror in interrogation. And this is played for laughs. It's played quite broadly.
They're playing bad cop, worse cop.
Yeah. And they originally, you know, and then there, of course, it ends in an explosion. It's like, Brent! It's like, we got him, Chief. The guy confessed. He confessed a bunch of stuff we didn't even know he did. But the anime goes around the creation of Bonaparte. So the first two episodes are essentially Leona being thrown out of the tank police, getting back into the tank police. Meantime, Annapurna and Unipuma put on a strip show, and oh, gads, what's it? Buaku steals piss.
Yeah, there's some weird stuff in this one.
He's stealing piss from very healthy people. Oh, the other thing that you'll see is there's a plot MacGuffin from the manga and the anime called Greenpeace Chlorios, which is basically a fairy-looking green figure with wings. Big iridescent wings. That's basically a living air cleaner that doesn't really have, may not be even sentient, but is there to clean things up. And you know who stole that design?
Who did?
Brave King, Galgaigar.
Oh, yeah. with like the main fucking character.
Yeah, the little fairies from Galgaigar, it's Greenpeace.
Yeah,
it is. It's
Green. Yeah, pretty much is.
It is. They didn't even try to hide it. Yeah, but you have the scene. I mean, and the reason that Dominion is beloved, the manga is beloved for certain reasons, mostly because it's just so dark and funny. The anime is loved because it's just outrageous and funny, especially the first two volumes. The second two are kind of serious and nobody ever talks about it, but the first two were on TV all the time. It has the phallic, you know, glory of the tanks pushed up to 11. They use spring-loaded dildo plastic inflatable balloons to trip up tanks. Annapurna and Unipuma put on a strip show for the police during the standoff. We have guys watching through their rifle scopes. It is a silly show.
Oh yeah, definitely.
It is definitely, and it is a wildly silly show, and it was all over American TV in slightly cut form most of the time, very early on. So Dominion is probably the most seen of all of Shiro's works, possibly more than even Ghost in the Shell, just for sheer broad audience. Now, he also did a subsequent manga one that was not adapted called Conflict One No More Noise, which is basically Dominion dialed back to the point of being basically a police procedural in a rather dark but not quite as bad world, by which point Leona's a squad leader and they have several, and the Bonaparte tank is a much more common tank design for everybody. That's the one where she
Bonaparte tank for me is kind of interesting because it's sort of a predecessor to the Tachikomas in reverse.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of the Tachikoma backwards and with tread wheels.
With special treads that could extend and let it climb buildings and get over heavy terrain and everything else. I always like Conflict. I always like No More Noise because he does it very much like, you know, you have a TV series and the squad room is the big chaotic mess that everything's going through. So he'll have a splash page every now and then of the squad room, and then he'll follow it off to some subplot or another that's going on. And there's like four subplots going on in No More Noise, and it's just, which one is he going to follow at this moment? Like, Breton is running into his older brother, who got arrested in a misunderstanding. One of her men has been asked to falsify some truck reports, and is also being eyed by the matchmaker, older policewoman, in the thing to go on some meet and greets. Leona is, meanwhile, being drafted into all the jobs that Britain doesn't want to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so on and so on. It's just, it's very much... Shiro loves his cop stories. Shiro loves the whole buzz of 180 things going on at once.
Oh, yeah, and sometimes this stuff can feel really busy.
Yeah, and No More Noise is him at his busiest, and it really works. But he's always been, you know, it's the guy with the futuristic robots, the girls, and the police stories. Sometimes the police are, at best, given a warts and all impression. And at worst, they can get a lot worse. In passing, I would say before we get before you mention Ghost in the Shell, you have to mention he also did a little short series called Orion, which was kind of a pullback to Black Magic. It was sort of techno mages in the near future. Nobody knows what the hell is going on in that story. That one has like Lovecraftian references, all sorts of different magical system references. It's a complicated story. Famously, when Studio Proteus was doing it, Torrance Smith tagged in Frederick Schult, the man who wrote Manga Manga, the original mm-hmm. book on manga, the guy who's done Rose of Versailles.
Yeah.
Tagged him in as an assistant translator. So they had two, they had a quick translator to do the rough translation, and then these two guys both looking over Shiro's story to try to figure out what the hell he was talking about. And this leads to a very famous line. I heard this straight from Torrance Smith's mouth in State College one time. Swear to God it's true. And this is for all you guys who think that you have to translate the words. No. There's some scene, and one of the characters spouted out some sort of reference that was just so archaic or so out there. And Smith looked at it, and he's like, I have no idea what the heck he's talking about here. So he got on the phone to Frederick Schult, and he said, Fred, you know, chapter 7, page 20, or whatever it was, mm-hmm. do you know what the heck he's talking about? Like, let me have a look. No, I don't really have any idea what he's talking about. So, Torrance Smith has something that most people would kill to have at those times, because this is when Shiro was still very much a hermetic figure. He has Shiro's phone number. So he dials up Kobe, and he's like, Shiro-san, I think he actually uses his real name, because he actually knows him on a first-name basis. And he's like, Shiro-san, yes, we're going good. How's it going with you? Yeah. On Orion, chapter 7, page 20, panel 4. What are you talking about there? He's like, Shosho Machikudasai. Give me a moment. I have no idea. So even Shiro didn't know what the hell he was talking about some of the time. She literally came back on the phone and just said, I have no idea what I was talking about in that panel.
Uh, Oh my God. So let's go ahead and move on now to, I would usually like to wrap up our discussions. Let's go ahead and talk about how do we go about finding these? Cause they're, you know, they're all from the late '80s, early '90s. So they, in some cases, but I think all these are actually not that difficult to find.
Yeah. They've been in print again, fairly recent memory. I think that the hardest one to find usually is the original Appleseed OV.
I think you're right, because I believe the only, I'll have to see here.
It's been reprinted OVA, in DVD.
Yeah, it's definitely been reprinted.
It's been good on DVD.
Let me see here. It looks like the last release would have been Discotech Media. And I don't know if there's been any new releases since then.
The Dominion ones, the second Dominion set might be also very hard to find, because I think that one might be out of print. But that one's also kind of missable. The old Central Park one was rescued and has been reissued. The other reason that one was also really popular for a long time is that one, when they brought it out on Laserdisc, they brought out all four volumes on one Laserdisc for about $50.
Which is a pretty good deal.
It was a big bargain in those days. It was a huge bargain. M66 has been in and out of print, but it's never been out of print for too long. It's never been impossible to find. It's just occasionally a little hard to find, and it's short, and it's not attached to anything. So it mostly gets sold on the fact of, by the creator of Ghost in the Shell, or similar things.
Yeah, I see that a lot of times where if a creator gets popular because of like their fourth or fifth work, you'll see from the creator of, and it's something that it's like, yeah, it's from the same creator, but they're still learning their craft when they're working on this. I think a great example of this that actually kind of blew up in their face was, as we'll talk later in the Gundam, you know, the Gundam Omnibus when we get to that one. We keep talking about it. Someday we're going to do it. Is Gundam Wing was really big in the States in the late 90s. And Bandai saw that, oh, this was really big. And they're like, obviously, they need to learn about the original Gundam series. The problem was that the original Gundam series was about 15 years older than Gundam Wing.
Yes. That was problem one of that release. There was problem two of that release, which is they released it dub only.
Well, they're only going to release it dub. Well, yeah, well, I'm not talking about just the releases. I'm talking about this them airing it on television.
Yeah.
Mobile Suit Gundam never pulled the ratings that Gundam Wing did. And it's because they looked at it and it looked like it just didn't look good. It looked cheap. Some people thought it was, I remember this, somebody thought it was knockoff Gundam, you know, on the playground at school. Because I was in elementary / early middle school when Gundam came out, so. In the U.S.
I will say this. The other part of doing it that way is you're actually screwing over the guys. There it was a small and, for their size, quite loud Gundam fandom at time. But they were older, and they would have wanted, you know, a deluxe collector's edition set with notes and everything else. They didn't want to see it on TV. They wanted them to release a good subtitled version, you know, preferably in packages. And they were like thinking, oh, we've made the big time. We got a big public thing. It's like, no, the guys who actually know anything about Gundam are 40 years old at that time. I mean, eventually, yes, we did get some people like you got into the original century, but it took a long time to build those. And then you guys kind of filled in for this, and you guys still didn't increase the numbers that much on the old.
Not really, no. We're
the old guard were a whole, you know, and they were a special breed.
Yeah, and we'll talk about all that when we get to our Gundam episode. But I think at this point, well, I mean, we've at this point, I don't have much more to say on these, Drew. Do you?
Cops, chicks, and robots. That's what Shiro's about. Oh, and dystopias. Usually the world's not in too great of shape when he's going. Very sci-fi. And by the way, Mr. Shiro, you're welcome. Because I don't know how much the U.S. made, his U.S. success made for his later success. Because it you know, pointed out that he had like worldwide fame, but it didn't hurt. Yeah. Certainly didn't hurt.
Well, I think that's just about wraps it up. So until next time, I've been Rick.
And I'm Drew.
And just remember, someone had to draw that.